From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a Boston judge makes a potentially landmark ruling saying climate change can be used as a so-called necessity defense. Climate activists are celebrating.
We are part of the movement that's standing up and saying we won't let this go by on our watch. We won't act like nothing's wrong.
Also today, should the internet be regulated? State legislators are looking to bring back net neutrality in Massachusetts, but internet service providers are pushing back.
Senator, I'm just going to say I've heard your questions before.
But you haven't answered them before,
no,
so.
No, but I'm going to say that I'm not the right person to ask.
Plus, why does it seem as if science and faith are always at odds? MIT physicist Alan Lightman reckons with a divide that he says shouldn't even exist.
I think that neither theology nor science can ever prove or disprove the existence of God.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This week, a Boston judge made what could be a landmark ruling on using climate change for what's known as a legal necessity defense. Let's go back in time here a little bit. Back in 2015 and 2016, hundreds of residents and climate activists gathered to protest the construction of a natural gas pipeline in West Roxbury and Dedham.
The sun is shining, and so are we. This is where.
So that's some sound of the protests from 2015 and 2016. And over the course of those protests, some 200 people were arrested. They were charged with various things, including trespassing and disturbing the peace. Now, more than a dozen of those protesters were set to go on trial this week on Tuesday. But on that day, Judge Marianne Driscoll found the defendants not responsible of lesser charges, saying that she believed their argument that their protest was necessary in order to fight the effects of climate change. Now, this could be the first ruling of its kind. So joining us now with more via Skype is Tim DeChristopher. He's the founder of the Climate Disobedience Center. He's also one of the defendants in this case. Tim DeChristopher, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you. Also with us in the studio is retired federal judge Nancy Gertner. She's a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, welcome to you.
Good to be here.
Okay, so first of all, Tim, let me just get your quick reaction to what this ruling was that out of this Boston court. How did you respond?
Well, it was kind of a mix of reactions for me and for most of our defense team, because up to a week before this trial, we expected to be able to have a full trial with a full necessity defense, bringing in expert witnesses to make our case and meet all the elements of that case. But then just a week before the trial, the prosecution dropped what were misdemeanor charges to civil infraction charges, mm-hmm. which meant that we no longer had the opportunity for a jury trial. And so that was really a big disappointment for us. And it meant that rather than being able to put on probably a week-long trial with all of this evidence, we ended up having about 2 minutes apiece to make this whole case in front of the judge. And so we took that opportunity as best that we could. And I think did present a coherent case within that half an hour or so, and were able to convince the judge that all of that evidence was out there and that this was a necessity to take action. And so that was very encouraging with the options that were still remaining on the table by this week.
Right. So I just want to take a step back here and get some context from Judge Gertner. First of all, when we talk about a necessity defense, Judge Gertner, what does that mean?
Well, necessity defense is actually a very unusual defense in the criminal law, because what it essentially says is that you have taken a step which is characterized as a crime in order to avoid a greater harm. And it's not an economic harm. There are very, the usual, the law school paradigm is you're going down, the railroad train is going down the track. And if you go in one track, you'll hit one person. If you turn it in the other, you'll you know, destroy a town, mm-hmm. and therefore you have a, you know, you're justified in hitting that one person. So there are various, it's relative harms. It has to be imminent. There are very narrow circumstances. So it's quite extraordinary that the judge did what she did here.
Okay, so Tim DeChristopher, just again in sort of lay terms, where is the argument that you were making that the climate change crisis is what necessitated the civil disobedience actions in Dedham and West Roxbury? Is that what you wanted to tell the judge?
Yeah, that's really the heart of it for a lot of us. You know, we were arguing that this pipeline represents an imminent harm, and that one aspect of that imminent harm is the prospect of that pipeline not working correctly, as in an explosion, because it runs right next to an active blasting quarry. And that's certainly what motivated some of the people in that community to act. But also the imminent harm if that pipeline works as intended and continues to exacerbate the harms of fracking that is wreaking havoc on communities in the Midwest and continues to exacerbate climate change by getting more natural gas to be burned and end up in the atmosphere. So we really said that regardless of what happens with this pipeline, there is imminent harm that is having disastrous impacts on our communities and on communities around the world.
Okay, so Judge Gertner, I'm reading here that Judge Driscoll in court said that she found the defendants not responsible again because it never went to jury trial,
right?
But agreed with their argument that their actions were necessary, saying that based on the very heartfelt expressions of the defendants who believe, and I don't question their beliefs in any respect, who believe in their cause because they believe they were entitled to invoke the necessity defense, I'll accept what they said. Okay, so, but I guess my question is, you were saying it's unusual. Is this the first successful necessity defense using climate change of its kind that we know of?
It's hard to say. This is a district court decision, so that it will not necessarily produce a precedent for higher courts or courts in other parts of the country. But the model is an interesting model. Usually, civil disobedience claims don't work as a necessity defense. It's one thing to say, you do it in the abstract, but usually they don't work as a matter of law. So this is unusual. She had to conclude that they reasonably believed that what they were doing was the lesser harm, that they thought that the harm was imminent, that this was the only alternative they have. It's a very narrow test. So it is extraordinary. I don't know whether it's, I would say it's extraordinary because this is, you understand that no one, that it could undo the criminal law. You can't say, for example, you can't use economic necessity because basically mm-hmm. that would justify so much. So it is a very narrow prong of the criminal law and a narrow defense.
So just to be sure I understand it correctly, though, it has to do with the belief about harm, not necessarily proving relative harm.
Right. It has to be a reasonable belief. In other uh-huh. words, someone can't be making it up. It has to be, they have to have reasonably believed that their acts were necessary to prevent a greater harm.
Okay. So, Tim DeChristopher, to Judge Gertner's point about this being a narrow ruling in a Boston court and that it wouldn't necessarily have any precedent on higher courts, nevertheless, are climate activists such as you now, do you feel emboldened to bring the same necessity defense to further cases down the line?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is the kind of defense that a lot of us have been trying to make on a lot of different campaigns in recent years, and have gotten close, have gotten certain aspects of it. And as far as we can tell, this is the first time that we've had an affirmative ruling like this on a climate case. The Climate Defense Project, rather, is a group of recent Harvard Law School graduates, Kelsey Skaggs, Alice Cherry, and Ted Hamilton, who have done a lot of research on this and helped us prepare this case. And it's the first one they've seen of their kind. We also had a lot of support on this from the National Lawyers Guild Mass Defense Chapter, which represented all 200 of the defendants who were arrested in this campaign. Mm. And it's for them, they've had necessity defense rulings that have won on other types of protest case, like other issues, but never on a climate issue. And so, so this does seem to be a new thing, and certainly something that we can invoke as an encouragement, even though it doesn't set a binding precedent.
I see. Well, Tim DeChristopher, founder of the Climate Disobedience Center, one of the 13 defendants in this interesting, potentially landmark case in Boston, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And by the way, we did reach out to Enbridge, the company that now owns Spectra Energy, the Spectra Energy pipeline. Just to so folks know, the pipeline was constructed. It's in operation now. And an Enbridge spokesperson told us, quote, the pipeline is in service. The court has issued its decision. We have no further comment. Judge Gertner, before I let you go, there's a couple of other sort of legal
stuff,
shenanigans,
right?
Things,
legal stuff
that I wanted to talk to you about,
right?
since I've got you. First of all, let's talk about the FBI, the ongoing investigation into potential ties between the Trump campaign and Russia, specifically Paul Manafort and Russia. Because I'm seeing here that in documents filed this week, prosecutors for Special Counsel Robert Mueller are alleging that Manafort and Rick Gates were in touch with a business associate who had ongoing ties with Russian intelligence. What does this signal to you about what Robert Mueller is up to?
Well, what he's doing is what prosecutors typically do, is he's starting from the bottom and building up. He's basically, so we started with the, not started with, but you had the 13 Russians who were indicted for hacking into the, for interfering in the election and dealing with Facebook bots, et cetera. Now you have a more direct connection between someone with ties to, or at least an allegation, ties to an intelligence community in Russia. And what's significant about this is that the filing talks about 2016. In other words, that this is not something going on now, but that it was also something that had been going on in 2016. And Gates, as you recall, is cooperating with the
right.
government. So this may well be the tip of the iceberg. But what Mueller is doing is building the little bricks of a case and seeing how far it goes. It may or may not go all the way to the top. But certainly this is closer to the Trump campaign than any accusation we've seen so far.
Mm. I mean, but the Trump campaign repeatedly says that that's a lot of this has nothing to do with them, that the original stuff about Manafort had preceded when he was attached to the campaign. But this is specifically during the period of the campaign.
That's right. And Gates had a role in the campaign, and this is occurring during 2016. But again, you have to think of it like bricks in a wall. These are bricks at the lower level. This is getting a little bit higher. This is now not somebody that you can, sort of say is not very important in the campaign. I mean, he was certainly involved in the campaign. And then how far up that wall is going to go, who knows? But the we've already established, or at least Mueller through the indictment has alleged, that there is a there.
Mm.
There is a Russian connection to the American election, both through efforts to hack it and through the Facebook social media stuff. This is now a connection between that, arguably, and at least someone like Gates and Papadopoulos and who knows what else.
Okay.
The other thing about Mueller, which is really quite remarkable, and as I've mentioned, I've known him and opposed him in cases, there are no leaks from his operation.
Nothing.
This is someone who is looking at this carefully and I think sort of not being distracted by the noise around him. So I think it's a very interesting development.
And so much noise. So much noise.
Are we going to talk about Stormy Daniels?
Since we have before two other times, I feel like we have our ongoing Stormy Daniels segment with Nancy Gertner. But I do want to just, because this is something related that you talked to us beforehand, because we were talking about the possibility of President Trump maybe facing deposition in the Stormy Daniels case. But today, we're seeing just a little while ago, a federal judge in California has put a temporary stop to efforts by Stormy Daniels and her lawyer to depose President Trump and Michael Cohen.
Well, it's actually the reverse in a way. Stormy Daniels' lawyer, Avenatti, asked for an expedited trial.
Right.
And an expedited discovery process. And the judge says, and really, I could see this tongue in cheek, saying, you know, I got a lot of important stuff in my docket. This is really not the top of the list. I'm not going to expedite anything here. And when you think about it, that makes a whole lot of sense. So it's not that there won't be a deposition down the line. It's just there won't be a deposition out of the usual course of events.
Okay. Well, Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's also WBUR's legal analyst. I'm sure we'll have you back again to talk about all things legal and probably more Stormy Daniels. Judge Gertner, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There was a tense hearing yesterday at the State House where some legislators are calling for state action to ensure equality and privacy for internet customers. Now, you'll remember that last year, the Federal Communications Commission repealed an Obama-era net neutrality regulation that was designed to require internet providers to treat all internet traffic the same. Massachusetts is now one of 27 states considering its own net neutrality regulations, but internet service providers here are really pushing back against that. Here's an exchange from yesterday between Tim Wilkerson, Vice President and General Counsel of the New England Cable and Telecommunications Association, and Chairwoman Senator Cynthia Cream.
Do your members sell aggregate customer browsing history to third parties?
And Senator, I'm just going to say I've heard your questions before, and
but you haven't answered them before.
No, but I'm going to say that I'm not the right person to ask because I frankly don't know all of the practices of our companies.
Interesting. Well, here now with more on the future of net neutrality in Massachusetts is State Senator Eric Lesser. He's on the special committee that wrote a state Senate report calling for new regulations here in Massachusetts. Senator Lesser, welcome to Radio Boston.
How are you, Meghna? Thanks for having me.
I'm doing well. So first of all, I mean, overall, give me the quick argument of why you think Massachusetts needs these new regulations.
Yeah, well, the bottom line is, you know, Massachusetts is a hotbed of the internet and the tech-focused economy. And so we have quite a lot more to lose from this sort of Trump-era rollback of an Obama administration protection. And, you know, ideally, this is something you'd want the federal government stepping up to do. But if the federal government isn't going to act, I think it's up to states like Massachusetts and California to fill that gap, because otherwise our residents and our citizens are really going to be at risk. And the innovation economy that supports so many jobs in this state would be at risk as well.
Yeah, well, so it's interesting because that same jobs argument, though, was made by those opposing net neutrality. We have a little bit of tape here from Gerald Keegan, Assistant Vice President of State Legislative Affairs for a wireless trade group, saying that there are 110,000 jobs in Massachusetts connected to the wireless industry, and they could be threatened by new regulation.
We believe that having state legislation in this area and risking that economic impact is too risky for the state to undertake.
What's your response to that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's something you often hear from industry groups. They're afraid of any type of regulation at all. But the thing I would say is the growth in the Massachusetts economy is not around legacy cable operators like that. It's around small entrepreneurial startups and new businesses being created, especially in the tech sector, that rely on free and open and unfettered access to the internet. It's also worth pointing out that these companies grew their presence in the state, grew their jobs under the Obama-era protection, FCC net neutrality order, you know, pending. So the idea that basically what we want to do, which is to put in place the protections that were already there and were just recently rolled back, is something that I don't think a lot of people in Massachusetts are gonna fully buy. And, you know, they're entitled to, and they have a legitimate point of view, but what we're trying to accomplish here is to just make sure that a principle of unfettered, you know, content-neutral access to the internet is protected.
Right.
And that's what's essential for the entrepreneurship, because the future of our economy here in Massachusetts is around allowing programmers, startups, kids in dorm rooms, people who are tinkering and exploring with new methods of delivering services and goods and ideas online, to be able to do that without a big internet service provider discriminating against one type of content versus another.
Let me just jump in here because, I mean, there's also this question, though, about whether or not the FCC or the federal government could just basically preempt any state law that's passed here in Massachusetts or elsewhere. I don't think there's any conclusion on that, but that is indeed a possibility. This might all be for naught.
Yeah, we had a lot of a back and forth about that at the hearing yesterday, and there's no doubt that there's a lot of federal preemption questions here. What we're trying to do, though, is in Massachusetts, we have a long history of consumer protections, anti-fraud protections, public disclosure requirements that are not specific to internet regulation per se, and we have a long history of those laws being upheld. So, for example, in California, where they recently passed a net neutrality state-based rule. One of the ways they crafted that bill to kind of get around the preemption issues is to regulate things like state contracting. So, for example, the state government can't enter contracts with internet service providers that discriminate or that block or throttle content. You can put in place disclosure requirements. One idea we had in the bill or in the proposal we're thinking through that the committee thought through and released yesterday is, for example, creating a public rating system so you could rate internet service providers in the state based on their adherence to net neutrality principles and publicly post that information. Yeah. So that consumers can make their own decisions. The other thing that's worth
Senator Lester, I'm so sorry to jump in here, but I'm almost out of time with you. And there's one more question I just wanted to ask, so forgive me on that. But I'm seeing here that the report that you put out calls for legislation to be filed in Massachusetts by April 18th. So we'll see if that happens. But I am wondering, I mean, the Obama administration didn't put its regulations into effect until 2015. And before that, I didn't really hear anybody in Massachusetts complaining that there were things going on that were inhibiting the innovation economy here. So what's the rush now?
Yeah, well, I think part of that is because there was an active process. I worked for President Obama for 4 years. I worked in his administration in the first 2 years of his presidency. And there had been active engagement on this issue for a long time. And so I think the states saw an active and willing partner in the Obama administration, and that allowed, you know, the process to work out on a federal level. Now we see outright hostility to the issue on a federal level, and that's what's triggering the pushback from states.
Well, that's State Senator Eric Lesser. He's on the Special Senate Committee on Net Neutrality and Consumer Protection here in Massachusetts. Senator Lesser, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about net neutrality with Hiawatha Bray. He's the tech writer for the Boston Globe. Hiawatha, hello.
Hi there.
Okay, well, so I know how much you love net neutrality. Just kidding. No.
Well, I'm a net neutrality skeptic in that I agree with what you said toward the end of the interview. We went throughout the history of the internet up until 2015 without these onerous FCC regulations, and somehow these guys did not slant the internet and slam all the doors so that we couldn't get to this or that website. It just didn't happen. And I don't think it would, because I don't really see a business case for doing it. It just seems to me companies really wouldn't have a good case for doing it. This isn't to say, though, that I'm totally opposed to what the state legislature is trying to do here.
Oh, this
First
is a surprise.
All,
okay, tell me more.
No. Remember, I last time we talked about this, I said I'd be perfectly happy if the federal government passed a simple law that said no blocking, no throttling, and just make that illegal on a federal level. I don't think anybody wants to do it. But if you had a law against it, no big deal. I think what the state is doing that is much more significant, though, is, as I understand it, this law is also going to set limits on the ability of ISPs to sell your data.
Right.
That is something that I think is a much more disturbing issue. And this law is going to say ISPs doing business in Massachusetts basically cannot just up and sell information about you without your permission. And that's something we very badly need on the federal level. And indeed, the Obama administration had issued regulations like that, and those were also withdrawn by the Trump administration. And that time, I disagreed completely, because that is something we very much need to do. The big problem, and this was what some of the critics of that regulation said, and they had a point, is that it's not enough to do this with Comcast or with AT&T or with Verizon. We got to do it with Facebook.
With everybody.
We got to do it with Google.
Yeah.
We have got to have a comprehensive law in this country that says you guys can't sell our data without our permission. You have to let us see the data you've collected on us.
I find myself suddenly, not that I... Am I taking the libertarian point of view now instead of you? Because what I hear you with these potential, with these proposals...
Yeah.
I mean, that would basically entirely undercut the business model for all of these companies. It could effectively,
well,
I don't know if they're putting them out of business.
Isn't that just too bad? I mean, I don't understand. Why is that? I mean, I don't understand why you would argue that a company has a right to collect indefinite amounts of information about everyone in America without us having any idea what they know about us, without us having any right to see what they know about us. I mean, it's worse than that. I mean, we're talking here about like Facebook, right? And the thing about Facebook is at least we tell them what we want them to know.
Look, just to be clear, you know I do not like the collecting of private information and selling that for profit. I'm just saying that, say these a bill makes it to the State House or on Capitol Hill, the first thing that Facebook's army of lobbyists is going to say is, this is Big Brother putting us out of business. We can't have this in a capitalistic free market society. We can't have
that.
Well,
they might try to make that argument, but I don't think they have it. I don't think there is such a thing as an innate right to sell what ultimately is your intellectual property. I mean, basically, it's a form of intellectual property, information about yourself,
exactly,
without some say of the person who ultimately owns this information, which is you. I don't think that's a violation of free market principles at all. It's my information. You should have to be accountable to me about what you do with it. But I want to make this point very quickly. We're talking about Facebook and we're talking about Google. The ones that also really scare me, and Senator Markey has talked about this, are the companies like Axiom and Experian and all these guys, because they're collecting data that we didn't even ask them to collect.
Right.
Remember the big Experian crack where they lost the data of 140 million Americans, and most of us are sitting there going, who are these guys? Where'd they get this information? We didn't even know they had it.
And why can't I get a mortgage? Exactly, because of them.
Exactly. And there has to be some kind of restriction that says you can't go gathering up from all the public records information about millions of Americans, put it in a central database, let it get stolen, and then say, oh, well, accidents may happen.
Yeah.
No, that's unacceptable.
You know, I want to know what you think of a particular idea. Just last week, I think, I talked to Jonathan Zittrain about this, and he said, look, there are other sectors in which we have working models on how to handle sensitive information. I mean, he was looking at healthcare, and people have a lot of rights over the information that doctors can use and share, et cetera. So we kind of know, we know how to do this.
We've got laws protecting the privacy of medical records. We've got laws protecting the privacy of some of our financial records. My favorite is there is actually a law protecting your right to have privacy in the videos that you rent. Somebody cannot steal and publish what you rented at the Redbox without breaking federal law. They have to keep that private. So why can't we have some kind of control over what these companies know about us? I don't see any practical reason why not. One thing, though, is this is an area where the states are probably going to have an impact, because if enough states legislate on that, the federal government may have to do something. And on the other hand, they may not. Remember the right to repair, where this whole idea was we wanted the car companies to tell us how their cars... Massachusetts passed a law requiring them to share the details of how their cars work so other people could repair them. And with that one state passing the law, the auto industry just basically said, the heck with it, we'll just do it. Because one state made it mandatory, they knew the information was going to get out. Something like that may happen here. If enough states say, we're going to do it this way, for example, you could imagine Facebook ultimately just deciding, forget it. We'll just have our own standards for doing this, and they'll be very open and very logical.
We got 30 seconds left, Hiawatha. Let me just ask you quickly about that, because, you know, of course, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg says he's going to testify before Congress at some point in time, but that also the company is introducing a new centralized system to help users control privacy. We got just 20 seconds. Is that a good step forward, at least?
It might be. We'll have to see what it works like. By the way, I'm writing today about how their plans to improve their apps are actually sound like a pretty good idea, and will work much better than the apps we have on our phones now. It could be a big step forward.
Hiawatha Bray, he's tech writer for the Boston Globe. We've got a link to all of his columns about this at radioboston.org. Hiawatha, thank you so much.
It's been fun.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Alan Lightman is a physicist and a humanities professor at MIT. He's spent his career swimming in that murky zone between science and spirituality. It's that space that we all stumble through, that contradiction between the material and the immaterial. And in his new book, we join Lightman on his own journey for truth and meaning. It all begins one night in Maine.
My story concerns a particular summer night in the wee hours when I had just rounded the south end of the island and was carefully motoring toward my dock. No one was out on the water but me. It was a moonless night and quiet. The only sound I could hear was the soft churning of the engine of my boat. Far from the distracting lights of the mainland, the sky vibrated with stars. Taking a chance, I turned off my running lights, and it got even darker. Then I turned off my engine. I lay down on the boat and looked up. A very dark night sky seen from the ocean is a mystical experience. After a few minutes, my world had dissolved into that star-littered sky. The boat disappeared, my body disappeared, and I found myself falling into infinity. A feeling came over me I'd not experienced before. I felt an overwhelming connection to the stars as if I were part of them. And the vast expanse of time extending from the far distant past long before I was born and then into the far distant future long after I will die seem compressed to a dot. I felt connected not only to the stars, but to all of nature and to the entire cosmos. I felt emerging with something far larger than myself, a grand and eternal unity, a hint of something absolute. After a time, I sat up and started the engine again. I had no idea how long I'd been lying there looking up.
Alan Lightman, physicist and professor of humanities at MIT, reading from his new book, Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. Professor Lightman, after that moment, what happened after that?
Well, I began getting more of an understanding of the allure of the spiritual world. I suddenly understood in a deeper way than I had before the longing for the permanent, the absolute, the indestructible, the eternal. And that, of course, contrasted strongly with my experience as a scientist.
Right.
And my whole life has been in science. And the scientist views the world in different terms, in material terms. Mm-hmm. Everything in the material world is impermanent.
Everything's in constant flux. Right?
Everything is in constant flux. But at this moment in the boat, I felt like I was connected to something that was permanent.
Can I, if you don't mind, can I share my own story of a similar experience?
Yes, please do.
So I also come from a very scientific family, and my educational background is in science and engineering too. But one day when my elder child was less than a year old, I was walking home from work here from the studios. And in fact, if we went out on the street, I could show you the exact location where I had this particular experience. And I was thinking about her and just sort of the how amazing it is that this like little collection of, you know, my randomly assorted DNA from me got transferred to her, mixed up with her dad's, to create this being. And you know, I get the medicine and the biology behind it, but there was something about how I was thinking about that at that moment, that it was dusk and the light was falling out of the sky, and it was exactly how you describe in the book when you were gazing at the stars. I felt almost like a tingling in my fingers, as if I were touching some sort of conduit towards immortality, right? Like I could see through my daughter and through whatever future she has, even beyond her, I could see my own path, my own existence traveling that direction. And it was a physical feeling almost. I mean, as you described, like everything being compressed down to a dot, and that dot was within me. Mm-hmm. And it was stunning. I will never forget it for as long as I live. I think it got me closer to a point where I said, okay, well, maybe this is the thing that people describe as when they see God, or they feel like they have a deeper connection with those very absolutes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily believe in those absolutes, but I can see why searching for them and experiencing them is central to the human existence.
Yes. Well, we could call that the transcendent experience. And I think that the transcendent experience is the best evidence we have for something you might call a spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to believe in God to have transcendent experiences and to feel this connection. I think that there's really a dualism in human beings, that on the one hand, we have our science and we want to have logical explanations for things that we see around us. Of course, that material world has led to antibiotics and smartphones, and we've benefited enormously from that view of things. And yet, we also are aware of our own impending deaths.
Right.
And I think that knowledge of our mortality is one of the driving forces behind our desire for something that's permanent, something that is eternal, something that doesn't pass away, something that's absolute.
This journey that you take in the book to explore that tension between the absolutes versus the flux and mm-hmm. the relatives mm-hmm. And the ever-changing nature of what we can know, how does science reckon with our need for absolutes? Basically, it says that there are none, right?
Well, I think that many scientists have what I would call an enlightened view, which is the realization that science does not describe all of experience. When I'm flying in an airplane, I'm very happy that the laws of aerodynamics are applying all of the time and not some of the time. So we really depend upon the reliability and the consistency of the physical world. But there are many scientists who acknowledge the existence of a spiritual world or a realm of experience that's in a different domain than science.
Now, is it that it's in a different domain than science, or simply that science hasn't been able to explain that domain yet?
Well, of course, we don't know the answer to that question because we don't know yet what science can explain that it hasn't yet explained. But we really don't know how far science is going to be able to go. Most religious traditions which believe in God believe that God lies outside of the physical universe, outside mm-hmm. of time and space. And if that's true, there's no way that science can prove or disprove the existence of God by definition.
But you know, I mean, when I hear that, sometimes I think to myself, well, when some theoretical physicists, for example, or cosmologists talk about multiverses, right? Or mm-hmm. in the other direction, the quivering of strings being the defining feature of the universe, I'm not quite sure what the difference is between those things and this idea of a God that exists outside of time
yes.
and space.
Well, I'll tell you what I think the difference is. It's a very good question, because those things, the multiverse and strings, also may be things that we can never prove. The difference is, I believe, in my view, the possibility of multiverses comes out of other theories of physics that apply to this universe and that have been confirmed. It's like seeing a door that's cracked and there's a dark room beyond it, and the door is open just a little bit, and you see the tail of an animal coming out. You don't see the rest of the animal, but you've seen other animals like that animal, and you recognize the tail. And it's a very plausible to imagine that there's the full animal behind the door, even though you can't see it.
Right. So it's the difference between what is unknown versus asserting that something is fundamentally unknowable.
Yes, I think that's right. And of course, the curtain keeps falling away from the unknown in science, whereas I think that neither theology nor science can ever prove or disprove the existence of God.
You know, it's interesting because this basic tension between science and spirituality, as you were saying a little earlier, there are many great minds who try to encourage us towards thinking that there should be no tension there at all, right? I mean, Carl Sagan once wrote that the notion that science and spirituality are somehow mutually exclusive does a disservice to both. And you quote Marilynne Robinson, the astonishing Pulitzer Prize-winning writer, and she says that we acknowledge that the physical brain is capable of such lofty and astonishing things that their expression has been given the names mind and soul and spirit. But nevertheless, I mean, your book here triggered by that experience on that island in Maine, you say that you go on this journey to explore that gray area between the absolutes and the relative. So where did that journey take you?
Journeys like that are full of contradictions and wandering paths. They're not straight line paths, and you don't really come to any conclusion. But one of the ways that I can express where the journey took me is in thinking about my own death.
Mm-hmm.
Some people believe that there's a soul that will last forever in some form. I don't believe that. I think that we're all atoms and molecules. We're a special arrangement of atoms and molecules that allow for consciousness, which is just a name that we give to the sensation of all of those electrical and chemical exchanges between neurons. That sensation we call consciousness. And I believe that when we die, that special arrangement of atoms and molecules will disassemble. And that's, in a way, an upsetting thought. But I derive some comfort in knowing that my atoms and molecules are still going to be somewhere, mm-hmm. even though they will not know that they were part of me. If you labeled each one with my social security number, you could follow all of them as they dissolved in the earth, were incorporated in plants and trees, dissolved in the ocean, and then came out again. And some of those atoms and molecules 1,000 years from now are going to be parts of other people. That gives me a little bit of consolation. To me, that is the expression of my spirituality.
Yeah. That sounds like a scientific framework for reincarnation.
Yes, but without the awareness they were part of me.
Is there something, though, about the information carried in those atoms that were once you, that are unique to you and your experience,
That persists?
Any of that information that persists?
No, I don't believe so, okay. Because the information is not in individual atoms. Yeah. It's in the arrangements of atoms. I'm a materialist, and I also consider myself to be a spiritual person. So you might call me a spiritual materialist.
Now, a part of your time when you were thinking about death, as we're talking about, you actually were in a Buddhist monastery in Cambodia?
Yes.
Can you tell me more about that?
I befriended many people there, but one is a Buddhist monk named Yo Hoot. I think people who are familiar with Buddhism know that they believe in something they call the Four Noble Truths, which all deal with suffering. But Buddhists also believe in certain things merely because they were uttered by the Buddha. One of those beliefs is that the universe has gone through an infinite number of cycles and will continue to go through cycles infinitely.
Mm-hmm.
So I asked Yo Hoot, how did he know that? And he said, because the Buddha said it in one of his sermons. Another word for the Buddha is the Lakavidu in Pali, which means the knower of worlds. And I wonder to myself, how do we know that the Buddha was the knower of worlds? Were Einstein and Darwin also knowers of worlds?
Why not?
Where does that authority come from?
And I think we grant that authority, right?
Yeah, that shows a big difference between science and religion and where authority comes from. If you build a pendulum and measure its swing and find a relationship between the time to make a swing and the length of the pendulum, you believe it not because you read it in a textbook, because Galileo said it. You believe it because you just did an experiment and found that to be the case. Science is constantly revising itself because it's constantly learning new things.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no ultimate or absolute authority in science.
And yet, you know, you make the point in the book, though, that there are a lot of very prominent scientists, or I should say there are some very prominent scientists who go to great lengths to use the tools of science to try and disprove the existence of a God. And you say that they're missing the point entirely.
I think they're missing the point entirely. This group of scientists has been called the neo-atheists, and the most prominent of them is Richard Dawkins.
Well, I mean, just to remind folks, you are a physicist. And so when you say that Richard Dawkins is missing the point, then what is the point that he's missing?
He's missing the point that God is commonly understood exists outside of the physical universe. Okay. And therefore, you can't use an argument based upon things in the physical universe to disprove the existence of God. That's the point that he's missing.
I'd add to that. I'd say that the other part of the point that they're missing is that people don't want God to be explained fully. That I think that, and I'm not a person of conventional faith, so I'm not speaking for them, but my sense is that part of the comfort in the absolutes is their fundamental unknowability.
Yes.
And that it's one thing that we are granted relief from.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, and to say, like, there are a set of rules or consciousnesses or intelligences or however, there's a divine presence out there that we will never fully understand, but I guess in many or slash most traditions has our best interests in mind. Like, that provides a great sense of comfort and relief. And so to be confronted with a group of people who say, well, we want to explain why it doesn't exist and we can't explain it, it's like completely different languages entirely.
Yes, I agree totally with you.
But, you know, so, I mean, this gets me to actually something that you point out in the book about the central doctrine of science, and that too is something that must be accepted as a matter of faith.
Yes.
So for people who don't know, when we say the central doctrine, what do we mean?
The central doctrine of science, basically that the universe, the physical universe is lawful, that all the phenomena of the physical universe obey laws and that those laws are true always and everywhere in the universe. We have to accept that on faith because we can't be certain that there wouldn't be some phenomena that we observe tomorrow that is completely unexplainable by science. And so in that sense, science and religion have a certain commonality.
You know, I feel like thematically a couple of different times in the book, you return to something, you grapple with something that's been a question that I've had about my own existence for a long time, and that is that, you know, I mean, fundamentally, we are all just human beings, that no matter how spectacularly complex our brains are, and, you know, and no matter what the truth or perception of the emergent property of our consciousnesses are, we're still just very meek and inadequate machines to really understand the vastness of everything. And to me, that is one of the reasons why religion and faith and the concept of the divine will forever be an irresistible force in humanity, because it is a way out of our own meekness.
Well, there'll always be a lot that we don't know.
And so many people have, despite being, you know, firm agnostics or firm atheists, they still are drawn back to this. I mean, you write in the book about Van Gogh, right? And his Starry Night, and that even though he rejects religion, he wrote to his brother once, is that right?
Yes.
About how he had to paint the stars because he was seeking religion.
Mm-hmm. Van Gogh hated formal religion, but he painted the sky. It's nighttime and it has this quiet village below. And then up in the sky, the vastness of the cosmos. And there's such a contrast between what's going on up there and the quiet human civilization below that's sleeping. I think that he felt that struggle.
Brings us back to your moment on the boat, right?
Yeah.
Looking up at the stars in Maine. So ultimately, you know, you talk about absolute versus relative. You talk about your view of what happens at death, whether or not consciousness is just something that emerges from all the electrical activity through the trillions of cells in our brains.
Mm-hmm.
But you go out of your way repeatedly to say all of these things may ultimately be explicable, but that doesn't reduce the experience of them.
That's right. And you could take an MRI machine and you could hook up every one of my 100 billion neurons when I was lying in the boat looking up at the stars, and you could measure the electrical output of every neuron, and it still would not explain what I felt.
Mm-hmm. I know exactly what you mean. And that's why, to me, it's it's fundamentally a beautiful thing. That feeling and that experience is, to me, that is how I understand the divine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Alan Lightman, physicist and humanities professor at MIT, the new book is Searching for Stars on an Island in Maine. It's an absolutely lovely read, and it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much for coming in.
Thank you, Magna. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And Professor Lightman will be speaking tonight at the Harvard Bookstore. We've got lots more information about that at radioboston.org. That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.